Welcome everyone back from what was a very tasty lunch, and we're going to start in on the second part of our program. For those who are just joining us here, this is the fourth of the Provost's forums on the public university and the social good. Our sessions today are really focused on the ideas of engaged scholarship and the ways that universities can both link in more productive ways with the broader communities, and how we can also engage in a more mutual learning mode. So this morning we heard some inspiring insights about how models of this, how this can work. This afternoon, starting now, we'll be thinking about how this can be institutionalized within the academy. And we have as our lead-off speaker here Ken Reardon. Ken is a professor and director of the graduate program in city and regional planning at the University of Memphis. He's a nationally renowned expert in community organizing, community-based neighborhood planning, and university community partnerships. He received the American Institute of Certified Planners President's Award for his role in establishing and directing the highly regarded East St. Louis Action Research Project, while a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And more recently has been involved in recovery planning for New Orleans Ninth Ward in collaboration with groups of planning students. We're really pleased that Ken is here. He's been an inspiration for me, although we've just met now directly as someone coming out of the planning field. And we'll both have his keynote, and then he'll be leading a more interactive session on really how this plays out in practice. So thank you for joining us, Jen and Ken, and let's warmly welcome.
So I'm going to tell you the secret of how to become a renowned, engaged scholar. I was finishing up my PhD at an upstate institution that will remain named. We refer to it affectionately as Uncle Ezra's Day Camp, high above Cayuga's waters, not far from where Nancy is the president and doing a remarkable job not only on the campus but in the city. And it's sort of set a very high watermark for what urban universities can do to help turn around a city. A lot of work in upstate, which has been losing economic activity since the Civil War. So there's a big trend to counter. But I was finishing up my PhD at Cornell. I was hired to teach in an interdisciplinary experiential education program. It was in the College of Human Ecology. It was set up by the great Uri Bronfenbrenner as a way to create opportunities for undergraduates, mostly, to be engaged in interdisciplinary research projects with community-based organizations on what Uri described as the unfinished work of American democracy, trying to transcend issues of race, class, gender, to really bring, finally, some reality of the promise of the American dream of the founding fathers and mothers to upstate and New York. We had some budgetary problems, which occasionally happens in New York, where it's a parlor game as to how late in the year you can not pass your budget, which I think we've trained the Washington, D.C. in. So the third Cuomo administration won. Cornell had to make some budget cuts, and we had this award-winning engaged scholarship program right at the point where nationally this was becoming the rage. And because we had chosen not to take tenured positions, we're talking about how do you both meet the needs to be responsible allies to community-based organizations and meet the ever-ascending requirements of tenure at a Research One university. We had read an article by a very influential dean of the Vanderbilt Medical School, Dick Coteau, a graduate of the 1960s Freedom Summer. And Dick had written an article called The Benefits of Marginality. He said, within cell life, the interesting things happen at the edge of the cells. I have to take Dick's word because I went to Catholic school where we didn't discuss the technical aspects. We just said God made it and it was good. And he said, in organizational life, if you're too close to the major masthead in the institution, if your office is too close to an uninspired provost, that wouldn't be the case here at Davis, you could be in trouble. It's best to be a little bit away from the centers of power. So we chose to have non-tenure track positions. They have budget cuts. The tenure track faculty get in a room and they say, okay, we got to cut 8%. What do we do? Eliminate Yuri Bronfenbrenner's dream program. And we all get fired. So I go on the job market. I go and give a talk on my dissertation, The Economic Development Reform Efforts of Harold Washington, First Black Mayor of Chicago. The head of the planning program at University of Illinois came up to me and said, come and interview. I get on the phone immediately because I just lost my job. And I call my wife and I said, what do you think about Chicago? And she's in shock. She says, the University of Chicago is going to hire someone like you? And I said, no. She said, Northwestern? Loyola, we're going down the food chain. I said, no, the University of Illinois. And she laughed. She says, you know where Urbana is? I said, well, you know, Oak Park. It's probably right next to that. We can hop on a commuter trail. Anyway, her response was, buy a Hammond map and call me in the morning. So I get the map, and being the consummate planner that I am, I don't want to actually use the legend to locate where Urbana is. I want to intuitively figure out Urbana, where would it be within Chicagoland? An hour and a half later, I realize it's 200 miles centrally isolated, and this is Nancy knows, from any place you'd probably ever really want to tell anybody you actually live, and I'm the newest faculty member in planning. I walk in, it's September, I meet the nice man who was dim-witted enough to hire me, even though I didn't know where his university was located, wonderful guy, Lou Hopkins. And he says, hi. He says, you're now the director of the East St. Louis Action Research Project. And I'm looking around. I'm from New York, as you probably could tell. And I said, I didn't see any signs for St. Louis or East St. Louis coming in from the airport. Just where the hell is East St. Louis? 188 miles as the crow flies from the central campus. So already, how is it that universities have a hard time finding a struggling neighborhood outside their front gate? Did we end up 188 miles down the road? Well, it's very interesting. The state senator from East St. Louis, Yvette Young, who just passed away, an amazing woman, who's the longest sitting African-American woman in any Midwestern legislature when she passed, just a beacon of good sense, courage, and great intellectual ability. And she had finally become, after years, the chairperson of a committee known as the Higher Ed Finance Committee of the state legislature, which is where the university gets their money. And so Stanley Eikenberry III was it the third? It was almost a Hollywood name. He was actually our system president, goes down for the annual State of the Campus speech, and actually the House and the Senate come together. They hear the governor one week, and the next week, the head of the land-grant university system comes. It's that important in a place like Illinois, where those values of the moral act of using knowledge to do good really matter. And right as Stanley was about ready to get up and take his mark, Yvette grabbed him and said, I'm the new chair of the Higher Ed Finance Committee, and I just want you to know, while smiling to him, that there's no chance in hell you're going to get any of your budget out of my committee until you make a commitment to East St. Louis, Illinois, where is my district, to demonstrate what you're going to do for, as an urban public service university, for a struggling African-American community. And in record time in higher ed, you know, the president calls the provost in, the poor provost has to drag three deans in, and the provost gets his pocket picked for $250,000 by the president. He then tells these three deans, you will go in the fall and do good things in East St. Louis. In the fall, the newest professor shows up, brand new, minted from Cornell. And, of course, I thought I was quite smart, at least I thought. I walk in, and I'm now the director of this program. I know almost nothing, really. And so I make my first trip to East St. Louis, and it turned out that this program had been going on for 10 years. And so I went and interviewed all the normal cast of characters, if you were running a real community development assistance program, who should know about it. The city manager, he said, what program? The head of the school board, you're here? Where? Are you running like the stealth bomber assistance program? Nobody knew who the hell we were. So then, being the smart, recently minted social scientist that I imagined that I was, I changed my question. Instead of saying, what do you think of the program, I changed it to, what do you think of the idea of a community development assistance program, long-term partnership between the University of Illinois, the great land-grant university, the Fighting Illini, and East St. Louis. And my favorite quote was from a renowned local leader. She said, "Honey, the last thing we need is a goddamn guy who looks just like you using $250,000 of state money that we could really use for a whole lot of important things, telling us what any sixth grader in town already has figured out." That was my introduction. So I was smart enough to decide to go back for a second tutorial with this person. Her name was Ciola Davis, a longtime outreach worker at Leslie Bates Davis Community Center. And at that point, Ms. Davis realized that I was a work in progress and I needed more education, a little bit more, you know, knowledging up. So when I came the second meeting, she had on her desk three milk cartons. One said 1960. It had 11 reports, $7.9 million. The next one, 1970s, 25 reports, $18 million. 1980s, 42 reports, $22 million, etc. She says, "These are the number of reports done by public universities, most of them yours, studying how rotten things are in River City. And half of this number on the side went for your university overhead so that the university could find its way to our community and deal with the extra expense. Yet in order for you to be successful in any of these, you need long-time community partners who can help you understand the history, the practices that have been attempted, what the current issues are. And there's no extra assistance for us. There's just a lot of extra work. And so the bad news is that you've created and practiced a form of highly repressive social science research that's mostly generated knowledge that's further demonized our community by showing how rotten things are. And she says, not one of the projects identified in here in the very thin recommendations about what to do. We're big on description, very little on prescription. We like to describe the world as it is, but we're not as agitated as Marx said we should to be talking about the way the world should be. She says, not one of those recommendations ever got implemented. So she says, that's the bad news. I'm saying, I'm glad to hear that. So, but there's good news. She says, resurrection is always available within the African-American community for people who have some humility and basic intelligence. And she said, we'd like to suggest there is still a way to pursue an honorable partnership between our community and the land-grant university known as the University of Illinois. We can actually establish a non-colonial, reciprocal, mutually beneficial partnership by adopting some very basic principles. And you should take some notes. And she asked me to write these things down for my boss. And so the first thing she said was, number one, since we live, work, worship, recreate, create the music, the culture, and knowledge that has kept this place together in rich and thin times, we should be the folks who determine what the research questions are. It should be a research agenda that is driven by the hopes and aspirations of the community, not of the needs of an assistant professor, as smart as he might be from Cornell University, to move up the ranks and get tenure at the home of the Fighting Illini. Secondly, she said, and I love this language, we're not interested in a one-night stand with the University of Illinois. Drive-by social science. Stay long enough just to figure out how bad things really are without noticing the incredible things that are still going on, that are functioning, when all public and private institutions are withdrawn in a place where the local economy has failed. And she says, so we need a minimum commitment of 5 years. And I'm like, oh my God. I mean, in a typical academic unit, community people, we try to keep this like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. Most department chairs can't even figure out what their faculty is going to teach the next year, let alone 5 years from now. So a five-year commitment is almost beyond the ability of most faculty to imagine. So 5 years, and then I loved it. She said, beyond your probationary year. So she was asking for a six-year commitment, and she was only going to commit 1 year to see how bad and how needy and how incompetent and how much trouble I was going to be working with my student. And I knew a little bit about probation because in high school I went to a Catholic school and we tried to reposition the Blessed Virgin in a more welcoming way at the entrance to our school. It didn't turn out very well. The Blessed Virgin fell on the ground. She lost her head in the process. And we all got probation, which is why I ended up at UMass and not Notre Dame. The third point she said, we decided the agenda, it's got to be 5 years. The third thing she said is, we want to be equal partners at each and every step of the research process. So basically she was describing a commitment to participatory action research, where local knowledge, as Gertz talks about, with the expert knowledge that White and others have talked about, collide, and you intentionally create as diverse a set of participants as possible to challenge taken-for-granted assumptions that often prevent you from getting a clear fix on the trajectory and the evolution of the problem, what the opportunities for resolution might be. So she says we want a participatory approach to doing the research, so that when you leave, and you will, when she said the shine goes off the apple in higher ed, when the scholarship of engagement is no longer on the top of the American Association of College and Universities annual conferences, we are still going to be here dealing with the effects of a 70 or 80 year process of deindustrialization, suburbanization, and disinvestment. And so we therefore want to make sure that there's ongoing capacity. So she said, we want you to set up an independent nonprofit organization that will actually be the policy guide for directing our ongoing partnership, and we want to have 55% of the seats on that group. So that was fantastic. Then my favorite one, getting down the list, we weren't finished yet, she said, is we want something called parity. She says, every dollar you feel you have to go and get to support the project in East St. Louis, we want 50 cents of it. Because you have special needs to come and bring the quad to the commons have special needs to accommodate the extra expense and difficulties and challenges of having a bunch of largely culturally uninformed and ethnographically challenged white folks from the suburbs coming down to help. You know, it's going to be a year before they can just keep from getting into a lot of trouble, before they can actually contribute. So I wrote these things down, and I was about ready to say, we'll do all of these things. She said, but don't tell me what your response to these requirements are. Just go back and talk to your dean about it. And I brought it back to Dean Conlin, wonderful dean that I'm sure Nancy knows. And she had theater background. She looked at it. She says, well, obviously, these people have worked with higher ed before. And she said, she wrote on the piece of paper, which she asked me to bring down. She says, we will do everything we can to honor the spirit and the letter of this agreement. And that became the foundation of what I think was a really remarkable, more than 20-year partnership between the University of Illinois and the East St. Louis community. And our partner there was a group called the Emerson Park Development Corporation. It was years before I found out where these women came from. And it was all women-driven. A woman by Ciela Davis was the lead organizer. When they were young girls in the 1960s, the NAACP came by in their youth development program and invited these women who were all living in Gompers Public Housing. That was the first public housing project in the state of Illinois. They had young children, and asked if they would come to the South to help organize in Ruleville, Mississippi, in the great organizing effort of Robert Moses, the good Robert Moses, not the planner, but the civil rights leader and the head of the Algebra Project, and Fannie Lou Hamer, whose name was in tone this morning, who became my major inspiration for doing the work that I've done the last 35 years. These women went down and were so transformed by the courage, the ingenuity, the guts of these women who were going around and organizing the local community to provide the spaces for the civil rights workers, that on the way back to St. Louis on the Greyhound bus, these eight women in 1964 made a commitment to creating a citizens' movement to turn their city around. I was showing up in 1990, and they had been at it for more than 25 years. And the way they got started, when they got back, they looked around the community, and they said, you know, you got to focus on the thing that may be not the most important, but it's maybe the most visible, and perhaps has some symbolic value. So there was, in front of the community center, three burned-out buildings. And these women, eight women, they recruited their neighbors to take down these three buildings, three-story buildings, brick by brick, stick by stick, pulled out all the piping, all the lead, all the copper wiring, put it all for recycling, got a local contractor to take it over to the Creeping Quiche gentrification district of Cherokee Street in St. Louis, where people like to have bricks with proper patina, And they got $15,000 for dissembling these buildings. And then for 1 year, they ran a campaign called Don't Cook Tonight, Call Ciola. And on Friday nights, you'd get a $5 chicken or fish dinner. And they made $15,000 grow to $20,000 because they wanted to do something spectacular for their first project. A drop-dead beautiful children's toddlers park in a space that was most evident in terms of what deindustrialization looks like in its most brutal form in their community. And so for a year, that's what they did. And then they looked across the river through the arch, and right framing the arch is the famous Dred Scott Courthouse, right? Makes an important symbolic point sort of looming over their horizon. And they saw a company that many of them supported one way or another. It was called Ralston Purina. And they went over to the nice people at Ralston, told them how many pets they had. They showed pictures of all the unsupervised animals in East St. Louis, which at that point was a large number. And they shamed these guys into matching their grassroots fundraising effort, and they built Shug Park. That was the first project. That gave a sense to people that even in the most difficult circumstances, by establishing strategic partnerships, they could make something happen. We got the park built. The next project was to try to remove illegal dumping in the neighborhood. And that was our first project, my first studio class, was to do a GIS analysis of illegal dumping. 1,407 sites in the city of East St. Louis, which was so broke in the mid-1980s, the city had eliminated most of its operating agencies. They were no longer paying their light bill. There was no street lights, no traffic lights. Between 1986 and 1992, there was no garbage collection. And unscrupulous trash holders from mostly Missouri, suburbanites, getting a deep discount on their trash collection would get 30, 40% off, because the trash hauler would then come at night onto streets that no longer had street lighting, and they would just dump 18-wheelers full of trash. And that's where all these sites came from. So my students started this project, and the residents were very smart, right? They didn't want to invest too much in myself. It was a smart move on their part, and my students. So they gave us something that we probably couldn't make any worse. The sighting of illegal trash. So we started doing the GIS work, and the students started doing calculations. 100 tons of this, 26,000 truck tires, 110,000 residential automobile tires, and I gave the question, how many years would it take the population of East St. Louis, 40,000 people, 80% of which are in households with no private automobiles, to generate 100,000? It came up to almost infinity. And so they realized it wasn't coming from the community. We realized we were being victims of environmental racism and injustice. And so the student said, well, can we start opening the garbage bags? And we'll start mapping, based upon the mail, what the mailing districts are, where the garbage is coming from. And so the students, we had one map. Garbage by type. We had an elegant topography. I never realized their garbage could come in so many different ways, in terms of what it was and how you could dispose of it, and what rules and regulations would be governed on it. And then the second thing was where it came from. And it came from 13 suburban, exurban, St. Louis County, Missouri towns, where just three trash haulers, all of whose names ended in a vowel, were providing deeply discounted trash and getting that discount by not paying tipping fees at a legal dump site. And so with that information, we were able to take it to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District. And with a very cooperative federal judge, he invited these gentlemen in and helped them see that if they made a $3 million donation, I think he called it a fine, they could maybe not go to jail this year. And that's how we got started. So a small park, the trash identification of resources, and then we worked with a whole set of public and private agencies to come up with a system to remove that trash using that first $3 million to leverage other public funds. We got all the garbage out. We were invited down for what I thought was a party. I'm Irish. We celebrate everything. It's Thursday. We should have a party. Tomorrow it'll be another excuse. So I came down with my colleagues who had worked on the mapping project. And as we pulled up to the site, which was at the intersection of the worst trash accumulation, all these elders parked their cars around us. I thought this was odd, right? And what they were doing is they were basically, it's the first case of professor hijack. They wouldn't let us leave until we made a commitment to transform the center of this illegal dumping into a site that could be of great pride for the community. So we've then built the first neighborhood scale playground. And we had our students in landscape architecture go back and we started doing some sketches looking at the best urban parks around the country, a lot of them here in California. And we went back to the community and a bunch of the elders who had initiated this process started scratching their heads and said, gee, what do we know about play? We're like 100 years old. We haven't really had a good time since D-Day, you know, or VJ Day. And I said, let's get the kids involved. So that's really when we began to then expand in terms of participatory action research, not just adults, but young people in the community. So we went to the Miles Davis School. Miles Davis grew up in this neighborhood. His father was a dentist. He apparently was an incredible pain in the ass, as you could imagine, as a young kid. He was totally difficult. He never went to school. His father was pulling his hair out. And because the African-American community was so pressed economically, he would often do barter. He'd do somebody's teeth, and they would do something for him. So a music teacher came in to get some work done, and apparently Miles was at his height of irascibility, which you can only imagine, because he had many heights of irascibility. And they made a deal. If you teach my son the piano, he had no interest in the piano, and the trumpet came out, and the rest is history. So in that school, we went to the Miles Davis School, brought out some pizza, gave the kids 60 foot of butcher block paper, and said, draw your ideal of a drop-dead beautiful playground. And it was fantastic. The room filled up with laughter, and kids started drawing these incredible structures that we couldn't either build or insure or pay for. But they did that. Then we hung this mural that the kids made up in the hallway, and for the next week we gave kids smiling faces. Put the smiling face on the element you most want, and then a skull and crossbone on the thing you least want. And then we came back a couple weeks later, and we had a scale cutout on the floor, green felt. And we gave the kids life-size cutouts of all the improvements. And the kids would take the swing set and put it where it would belong, as they view, in their new park. And then they would take the flower beds, raised beds for the elders and folks with physical limitations. Where would that be? Everything's going great, but I keep noticing that there's this young girl named Maria, and she keeps putting the seating area for the elderly at the bottom of the sliding pond, you know? And I'm thinking, you know, we would say my undergraduate degree in social work that she had some issues, little elder side issues. So I, you know, she put the grandparents under the bottom of the slide. I would remove them. She was put back. I would remove them. And then finally, this girl, so room of 60 people, a couple of ministers, the school principal, and she screams at me, you don't understand anything. My grandparents will never let me come to this park if they're not right in the middle. They view it as being safe. Don't you understand anything? And I thought, wow, I'm like, you know, totally leveled by this brilliant and courageous 11-year-old, right? He's going to tell this 40-year-old white guy from the university with a PhD behind his name that he has his bearings incorrect, right? Then she went on all the other stupid things about the design. And they were brilliant. So we had this big storage area that we were going to reinforce with concrete and steel bars. She says, that looks like Fort Knox. What are people going to think is in there? Gold. And every week they're going to tear that up. What, to save you $3 in crappy basketballs? And she just went down her list. And by the time they got done deconstructing our park, it was completely reimagined the way that it would work in their environment. And we realized that they understood at the micro level things about that space and place and the community and its history and its culture that we did. And it was really fabulous. They did a design, and then we had little or no money in Illinois. Things weren't going too well.
You're pointing at me.
Yeah, no, listen. Nancy was an incredible breath of fresh air. And we then took this design, and we had the kids go before the two largest black churches and present it. And the one minister has become a very good friend, Herman Watson. You might have known him as an international boxing star, but he had one little minor moment of inattention. So the kids are up, and they are really excited, describing what this playground could look like. And Reverend Watson leaned over to me and said, "You're going to hell." I said, my mother has already told me that, but could you give me the theological reason for why? He says, you're turning the entire church, you're putting us in a position where we're going to have to build this damn thing. You're organizing the village to pressure the elders to create this thing. And, you know, I said, well, if you have to go to hell for one reason, that's not a bad one.
And so his church mobilized. He got the other black ministers to mobilize. And it was really remarkable. We started getting phone calls. People were so excited about this happening. A guy calls me up. He moved down to the neighborhood 40 years ago, but he has a concrete company. He calls me up and says, "Do you need mud?" I'm thinking, mud? You know, I've never done construction. So, you know, yes, you do need mud. We're doing sidewalks and et cetera. And this guy shows up 2 days before we're supposed to do it, puts all the forms in with his sons, and does all the hardscape work for us. And the morning we went down to build was at 5 o'clock. We came down to set up our volunteer areas. We had adults from the community. Black church women were going to feed us. We had an area for that. We had some tents to do first aid because we weren't very competent building things. And 5 o'clock in the morning, I show up. There are already 12 young children and their aunts and grandparents on the site. And I was like blown away. So I get out and say hello. And I said, "And what are you kids doing so early?" I'm thinking that maybe, you know, they're going to go to an early church service or something, or going to go over to the farmer's market in St. Louis. They said, "Well, we designed it. Of course we're going to build it, right?" And their mothers told me that they hadn't been able to sleep for 2 days. The excitement of imagining something and working through the process, making the presentation to the church to create something of beauty in a place that so desperately needed it. And so it was harrowing. We had adults, little kids. We have great pictures with kids waving to the videographer. And their hands are so small, they look like, you know, the Disney characters with oversized hands. So we built the playground. That got an enormous burst of energy from a wider range of neighborhoods. As a result of that, we started organizing what became known as volunteer work weekends, where residents would identify homes owned by elders or low-income families or people with physical disabilities that were threatening to go from being perhaps needing a repair to dilapidation. And we started raising money on the campus and in the community to, looks like it's on, in the community to then do what we called minor home repairs. And it got to the point where the class that did the first garbage study had 11 students in it. By the third or fourth year, we were bringing between 50 and 100 students to East St. Louis every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday for 20 years to do projects identified by the community in which they mobilized local folks. We would never do a project unless there was a local community manager, support team, and they had participated in the planning. We would then bring the resources from the university. And in the typical weekend, students would be involved in facilitating a neighborhood meeting on Tuesday, maybe helping do sign-in, taking notes, doing some sketches. The next day, they might do a survey of a new area in terms of what they might need in terms of senior housing. And then they would spend 2 days doing construction. One of the brilliant ideas I came up with is that we always came back on Saturday night because, you know, you have to have 1 day of rest. But in the neighborhood, the real activity is Sunday morning in churches. So I decided one weekend with a particularly malleable group of very enthusiastic graduate students who I thought I could convince to do this. I said, "We're staying until Sunday afternoon, and Sunday morning we're all going to church." And it's like in absolute unison. "This is a public university. My mother can't make me go to church. I'll be goddamn that some professor in city planning is going to make me go to church." And I said, "Listen, we are not bringing you to a Baptist church to make a good Baptist out of you. Let's face it, Jonathan, you don't have the stuff to meet with." There's a limitation to the resurrection potentials of a secular professor. But this is where people get together. This is what's held their community together. This is what gives them the strength to deal with incredible structural forces of destruction. And we have to understand that. And it was easy to make that speech. And of course, they sort of, they liked me, at least at that moment. I hadn't given any really bad grades. So they went along. So the next day, we're dropping them off in groups of 3 and 4. I have no intention of going to church. I am going to go to Our Lady of Dunkin' Donuts, read the New York Times. 3 or 4 hours later, I will go and pick up these poor folks and hope they're still standing. Well, we're dropping everybody off. The last 4 kids in the car are 2 Japanese students and 2 young guys from Alabama A&M who just their first week in the graduate program. And I go to drop them off, and this young kid, his name's Howard Johnson from Alabama, says, "Well, you're coming with us, right?" And because these Japanese kids, I bet you they're not quite ready for what they're going to experience in this church. It was a full-blown, full gospel, evangelical, the nurse corps with the fans. And, when these young girls went to temple, contemplative, quiet, meditative. This was going to be a shock for them. So I said, yeah, maybe I ought to come. So I go in. I've been a Catholic my whole life. And, you know, for the first many years, the priest did his back to you, spoke in Latin. The idea was to get out in 20 minutes. And you go in. And I thought this was, like, something I had never experienced in my life except on Broadway. You know, there was incredible music. There were liturgical dancers, these 250-pound men who looked like they could play linebackers for the Ravens, doing spins and splits. It was incredible. And then the sermon, where the word was really taken seriously, deconstructed, and just elegantly done. And I was totally taken with this. I can't sing. I was singing. I was swaying. Everything was great. And then all of a sudden, I hear, and Professor Reardon is here with his students from the University of Illinois, and he's going to explain what where his home church is and what his ministry is here this morning. And I'm like, oh my God, 800 African American folks who I just met who watched me be incompetent a whole host of ways already. And so I got up and I thought, you know, should you just lie and claim a home church? You know, in the Catholic Church, you just go to confession, you can wash away. But in the Baptist, I don't lie. So I told the truth. I wasn't really fully churched up at that moment. They all applauded. That scene, that was flawed. It was good. And then I said, we're from the University of Illinois. We're your state university. We have a land-grant mission to try to bring to communities and to raise up in communities knowledge and skills and resources that can help address the concerns that you have. And we're doing a planning process in this neighborhood. You might have seen the daycare facility we worked on, the cleanup, and some of the park activity. We're now doing the next phase, and we can't imagine going forward without your input. Standing ovation, 20 people thanked me, hugged me, kissed me. I had lipstick all over, as they call it, giving you sugar, lacing sugar on you. I don't know what the hell they were talking about. But that act was extraordinary. Years later, we did a 10-year evaluation of the project, and somebody asked this morning, how did you decide to trust this guy, Jonathan London, from UC Davis? And one of the first things that folks said at the 10-year evaluation was, you came to our church, and you came to our church every 3 months. It was such a powerful connection, and we started getting buy-in, people started to come, that we came back to report what had happened. And after a while, we didn't have to do the reporting. Folks from their congregation were involved, would come back and do the report. And they said it was so unlike the politicians who would come only on election, do a quick thing and say, I'd love to spend time with you and hear what you're doing, but I have to go to a really big, important church now to do my rap. And they said that really mattered. The second thing they said, the 10-year evaluation, was that they had heard the story of this little girl telling me I was full of hooey. After all the design work we had done, we had to throw it all out and start over again. And the fact that you listened with great humility and actually changed what you were doing based upon local knowledge and the fact that you made a long-term commitment. So we did these projects. We did these, we called them scrape-up projects, the home small home repairs. The state found out what we were doing. They then started giving us allocation of home funds to do moderate rehab. We started doing that work. We would then do all the paperwork. Local black contractors would get the jobs, and we would do the finish work. So if we got 50,000, and you could do maybe 3 homes, we could stretch it to 4 by having university students do the painting and the staining and the demolition and all the unskilled stuff. And the local black contractors who never had a chance to get into that market were able to do that. So we did that, and it was going along pretty well. And then a person came up and said, you know, we got all these nice houses now, but there are all these missing houses from the out-migration. We'd like to build new. Well, we knew the incomes were so low, so Habitat for Humanity came to us and said, we'd like to help you start building some houses in the neighborhood. We explained that Habitat at that point took no grants. You know, you paid for everything. What they did to get the prices down was to squeeze out the labor costs, right, by doing all volunteer work. But our people, even with that reduction, couldn't pay for these houses. We couldn't keep them going. We needed to do something with grants on top of the labor for the materials, et cetera. And the Habitat director, I loved it, had his hat on and a Jimmy Carter hat. And he flipped it over and said, well, how about if we formed a new organization? I said, well, I'm sure one. He says, well, we'll call this the East St. Louis Faith-Based Housing Initiative. And we'll take subsidies. We'll use the same infrastructure that we have for Habitat. And we'll accommodate the lower income needs. And we started building some new houses. And that was really extraordinary. The residents would identify which family was in the greatest need. They would mobilize volunteer hours so that that family, regardless of how much stress they were under, could meet the local contribution requirements of Habitat. And our students, architecture and planning and landscape students, sitting down with a family and doing a design on a board, right? And then 3 months later, they do the opening, and they ask those students to give the keys to the family, and then to go in and see a house that was just a sketch, that didn't have the love and attention and sense of history and more memorialization of the families and what they've accomplished. To see a family turn a structure into a home, our students would just weep to realize that they've had a small hand. Now, I could go on, as you can imagine, but since we don't have that much time, let me just give you the final chapter on this and then some quick reflections. We did the infill houses, and then one morning, it was on my birthday, September 15th, please write me, K. Reardon, Memphis.edu. My mother always would call me at 5:34, which is when I apparently hit the deck at Misericordia Hospital in the Bronx. And so this morning, I'm in bed with my wife, now 30 years, and the phone rings at 4:58. My mother was a bookkeeper. And I thought, oh, a little odd. So my wife, Rita, your mother, here. So I got on the phone. It's not my mother. It's some crazy lady from East St. Louis. They're going to build a light rail line from St. Louis International Airport down to the casino districts on the waterfront. All we have to do is get them to extend it 13 miles into East St. Louis through the poor census tracts where you're already working, right? And then we'll have access to living wage jobs back at the airport. And with those living wage jobs, we'll be able to have the income to build out the rest of our neighborhood. I'm saying, this is fantastic. Who the hell is this? Well, Ciela Davis. So we organized a project called the 1001 Reasons Why the Regional Transportation Project is ill-conceived. We'll use those polite words. And we organized students in archaeology because we have all these wonderful Native American sites and African American historical sites that had never been properly identified and interpreted that could be a part of an argument for why there'd be sites and locations to get reasons to get off the train if we could get it to the extended. We got the economics department to lay out all the reasons why you could make a light rail system be less of a money loser by having two-way traffic. You take people in from the airport in St. Louis into the downtown, but then you can get folks from East St. Louis and take them back out to the airport, where otherwise the trains would be empty until the end of the day and vice versa. So the St. Louis Metrolink has become one of the best producing, it still loses a lot of money, but for a low-density urban system, it's done very well because of Ciela Davis. All we had to do is get the Federal Transportation Agency, two state legislatures, about 14 municipalities, to decide to spend whatever 13 miles worth of light rail costs. I think it's a huge number. And these folks, they said, let us worry about the organizing, you worry about the arguments and supporting the extension. So we did this project, and one evening in East St. Louis, Ms. Davis organized a community meeting in this Leslie Bates Davis neighborhood house, gym. She got 500 of her best friends to come. It was packed. In the middle was a little circle, and in the circle where there were three chairs, the mayor of St. Louis's chair, the mayor of East St. Louis's chair, and the head of the Regional Council of Governments chair. And when I went over to look at them, and she had the local community college come with their videographers, and they had these big art lamps, these clique lamps, what is that we call them? And so these seats were already like 120 degrees. And I'm thinking, this is interesting. And the seats were also all wobbly. One leg on each seat was shorter than the other. So I said to Ciela, I said, you know, you got to change out those seats. She laughed. She said, it took us an hour to find them. She says, these are professional politicians. These guys know how to tap dance in front of any audience. We're community folks. We rarely get a chance to get up in the comments and make our case. We need whatever edge we can get. So those seats were scientifically chosen. They're ergonomically incorrect to the maximum. Taking on our Asian American women colleagues doing that great project with immigrant workers and the seamstress industry. So the room filled up, our students got loaded with all the departments one after another, ready to deliver like an hour and a half research report. These poor guys are sitting there, and the mayor of East St. Louis is a guy named Gordon something, I'm blanking on his name. He was follically challenged, bald man. And of course, the cleat lamp is on top of him, so he's sweating and then he's blistering. So we only got up to city planning's arguments. We never got to engineering and landscape and all the other reasons why our plan was superior to the regional plan. And finally, he got up and says, "I think I know where this train is going. Do you have a route?" And we had little kids from the neighborhood. We went over to the wall, we pulled the string, and we called it the laser line. And the laser line was going to go through all of the poor census tracts in East St. Louis, where we had quietly assisted community-based organizations to acquire the land around the proposed stations. So it was speculation for social justice. We were doing the planning and we were advising people in the neighborhood who, if we were successful, to buy the land, because that meant that any development near the train station, so close to downtown St. Louis, highly desirable, and if they owned the land, they would be at the negotiating table, led by Stilda Davis. And if she was going to be on that side of the table, I knew things would turn out okay. And so the mayor gets up and says, "I'm for it." And they said, "Well, we'd like you to sign something." So he goes over to sign the map, and he signs the map, and then Stilda Davis signed three separate copies of an agreement that he would support this. And so now today, you have a 13-mile extension to East St. Louis, and it allowed for the development of neighborhoods that would have never occurred, and that was not a proposal from well-trained planners from the University of Illinois. It was from grassroots leaders who were active in the local political party system with all of its flaws, who got an early warning and knew that this made economic sense, environmental sense, that it would promote a more just pattern of regional development. As soon as that happened, a miracle occurred. Like the dead arising, Lazarus coming out of the tomb, right? It's Lent, so I'm into a couple of badly referenced religious notes. All of a sudden, developers started coming across the bridge from St. Louis to East St. Louis, because now we had the most desirable, already publicly assembled land, albeit under the control of Stilda Davis. And we wanted one developer, Baron McCormick Salazar, the best builder, I think, of affordable housing. But he had never worked in East St. Louis because it was a political mess. So St. Louis University was setting up an urban planning and landscape architecture program. He was funding the whole thing. I got invited to be the keynote speaker at it. They didn't know me well enough to think that, and realize that would be a bad idea. And my whole presentation was the seduction of Richard Barron. Why we just couldn't have any developer. We needed an inspired developer. We didn't need any developer. We needed a developer who would create living wage jobs. We didn't need, and I went on and on and on. It was embarrassing. We showed every slide that we showed, great examples of what we wanted our project to look like, was one of Richard's buildings. Everybody in the room realized, so I'm leaving, and I go outside, not knowing Mike Andreasich from Architecture and I, we did the pitch together. And we go outside, and this big arm on my shoulder, and a door opens, and he pulls me into the mop closet, the janitor's closet, says, "Okay, you got me." And as a result of that, McCormick Barron Salazar made a commitment to do a mixed-income housing project in the middle of that neighborhood, which is stunning. It has a full city block park with an Olympic swimming pool in it. It's named after Stilda Davis. On one end of the park is a Montessori school with 80 slots. On the other end of the park is a middle high school, a charter school, the Fannie Lou Hamer Youth Empowerment School. It has among the highest test scores in the metro region. Why? Because all the classwork at that school is connected to the adults' ongoing community development activities in the neighborhood. So you don't want to come to school on Monday, because you told me you were a little school challenged. But on Monday, we're doing a ramp for a Gulf War veteran. And you know that man, and you care about him, you're going to go learn all the mathematics, do all the geometry, learn all the calculations necessary related to math to figure out the materials, do the buying, et cetera, et cetera. On Wednesday, you still don't want to come to school, but on Wednesday we're doing a raised bed herb garden for the Senior Citizen Center, and you're raised by your grandparents and your aunt and your aunties, so you're going to be there. So they get an incredible attendance. And the last thing I would say about the project, and then just 1 minute of reflection about its impact, is that it also began to change the perception that elites in the city and the region had of young kids of color. Because every time they turned around, they saw these Fannie Lou Hamer varsity jackets out building incredible things. So I knew that we had really made a change when one day I was out supervising some kids doing a landscaping project from the high school, and a federal judge stopped by on his way home, and he asked the kids what they were doing. He was a gardener, so he was totally captured by what they were doing. Said, "You need more materials. I'll come by tomorrow when my day off Saturday, and just tell me what kinds of things you need. What's your plant palette, etc." The next day he came by with a wad of business cards, and he said to the kids, "If you need summer jobs, I will hook you up." Now this would have never happened. There was a complete city trench separating the lives of a federal judge in East St. Louis, completely surrounded in a gated community to the max, and these young people. The last thing I would say is about this is the impact that it had on our students was in many cases life transforming. I've just finished finally the book on this project. It's called Wading in the Water, the Emergence of Empowerment Planning in East St. Louis. And it's dedicated to these eight women and to the leadership of Ciola Davis, who was the prophetic voice that made this happen and continues to make incredible and possible things happen in that city. But the young people who got to see these women take on such incredibly difficult issues with so little support, and then to see that your technical training, if humbly offered under a resident-led process, could in fact have a transformative impact, has stayed with these kids. So 2 years ago, I went down to the Gulf. We did some work in the Lower Ninth Ward on the recovery plan with Acorn before they got canonized. And I'm looking at one of my former students. She's the head of all Enterprise Foundation housing projects, the whole Gulf, $300,000, Michelle Wetton. I look up and I see a picture of Ciola Davis at a ribbon cutting. It's brand new. And I said, "Michelle, I'm really interested in this picture." She starts to smile. She says, "Well, they were doing the senior housing project, assisted living, and they were $4 million short." She graduated from the University of Illinois 15 years ago, but 2 years ago, she found $4 million from a socially responsible investment fund to make that project happen. The current chief counsel for HUD, Damon Smith, his grandfather was a Tuskegee Airman, his father head of affirmative action at Ohio University, he claims that he comes from the Ciola Davis School of Planning, and he is the senior advisor to Sean Donovan. We're currently in the process at the University of Memphis of fighting our local housing authority to keep the last 420 units of public housing in the city. And we're not getting much help from our city officials. I was able to call Brother Smith, and within an hour, the mayor, who hadn't returned my phone call for 3 months, called me up to say that he'd love to meet with me on Monday. The most recent commissioner of housing for the city of New York, Rafael Sestero, graduate of the East St. Louis School of Planning at Ciola Davis. And my last example would be Juan Salgado, who runs one of the co-directors of the Resurrection Project, was one of the key leaders in the immigration reform movement in the latter years of the Bush administration, was invited to give the joint presentation before the Senate and the House for the Republic of Mexico about the grassroots effort to push immigration rights and reform in a positive direction. He's graduated the East St. Louis School of Planning. So it not only, I think, supported an amazing resident-led effort that made significant improvements in that community, but it also changed the professional imagination and commitments and career trajectories. It did great things for the university's design programs, which started attracting people from all over the country who would never imagine going to Champaign-Urbana to do urban anything, because we don't have an urban, right? All of a sudden, it became the place to go because you could do interdisciplinary community problem-solving research, et cetera. And then the last thing is that the East St. Louis model of empowerment planning has developed quite a lot of national and international traction. It was a best practice by HUD. It was a best practice at Habitat 2. And currently, I'm working with a group of trade union leaders in the Simeto River Valley in Sicily, in a new town that was built in the 1970s that now needs to be redeveloped. And they went on the web, and then they consulted with Habitat 2. They said, "We're poor, but we have lots of practical knowledge, and we have a university nearby. Is there a model that we could draw from?" And so now we are consulting 20 years later with the University of Catania and their work in the Sonoma River Valley. So it also has some international gravitas and is a very developed theoretical model, which I won't go into, but it combines participatory action research, direct action organizing, and the popular education work of bell hooks, Miles Horton, and Paulo Freire and Danilo Dolce. Thank you.
Ken, that was beyond amazing, and ending it with the pantheon of gods of bell hooks and Paulo Freire and Miles Horton and other just cemented you in that pantheon too. So maybe that's building you up a little bit, but I think you deserve that. And thank you so much. Come back.